Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium. Two copies.
Welcome to Cavaliers Break Bad, the best entertainment short of two copies of Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium. See, this was what brought Walt down. Greed. See, if he just settled for one copy of Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium, perhaps he could have kept his family, Hank would still be alive, and Jesse would be happy with Andrew and Brock.
I think it's
But no.
It's the moment of
the
show.
He had to have two.
Probably wants three.
Yeah. The sky's the limit. Where's he's in the Mr. Megorium DVD empire business. Anyway, I'm Saro.
I'm Grippy.
Anyway, I was really looking forward to doing this podcast. We did it right after we did Ozymandias because of technical difficulties.
Yeah.
So
yep.
If you just kind of up, like, you know, this is download and you haven't noticed, we also have an Ozymandias cast up. So you should listen
to that.
Finally. I was really excited to talk about this episode because I've just been kind of reading the critical consensus on it, and it's pretty...
It's not harsh.
For Breaking Bad, it's lukewarm because it's not Ozymandias and there's not lots of explosions and people dying and catharsis. But it's one of my favorite episodes of the show. I really loved it. I thought it was pitch perfect. I had one problem, which I call gliding overall syndrome. Another episode that I loved, but I have to acknowledge had some kind of structural difficulties getting around the fact that it has to do a massive time jump. And it's not something that dragged the episode down in any significant way, but...
Those two sequences, the prison murders and the... Crystal Blue Persuasion sequences are two of the greatest sequences in Breaking Bad.
Yeah, and this episode, because it's much quieter and kind of sadder and subtler, doesn't sort of get a big flashy sequence.
Oh, and I must mention that as a result of that, Kelly Dixon just won her first Emmy for that very episode.
It was her first Emmy.
Oh, well, regardless, she won an Emmy for Gliding Overall.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, anyway...
But she won that a while ago, because they do the technical Emmys before the regular Emmys.
Yeah.
We mentioned this in Ozymandias, but Breaking Bad won an Emmy.
Yay.
And Anna Gunn won an Emmy.
Good on ya. Good on ya. Stick it up those misogynist fans in inverted commas.
Fuck the haters.
Fuck the bad fans. The bad Breaking Bad fans.
Anyway. So let's jump into this
Granite
episode,
State.
Granite State.
Written and directed by Peter Gould, who of course did... Episode 7, Season 4, Problem Dog. It's a brilliant episode.
Good episode.
And, back in the writer's and also director's seat, long-time producer, long-time part of the creative writing team, and also showrunner on Better Call Saul.
Yes. Soon. And it's also interesting in what could very well be the last appearance of Saul.
Yeah. I
think when talking about this episode, you know... Saul's disappear has been such a kind of elusive, important plot point for so long that I'm thinking, I'm going to get someone famous to play
that. Yeah,
and
we talked about this.
And, like, I kind of thought they can't really do it because...
It's TV. It'd be one episode.
Well, it's not just TV. Like, there'd be plenty of... But, like, it's Breaking Bad. They can't really just destroy that integrity that they've built up with the gratuitous guest appearance. But Robert Forster,
and particularly for us, like I know when I saw that pan, like it's not even just the camera rise up to him, because there is this curiosity about who is this guy that like they've been talking about for so long, and like I remember like kind of I think we joked about it a couple of weeks, like they'd get on like Bill Murray or someone or just someone really funny, but they just get Robert Forster, and we love
who's
Robert Forster.
Perfect. He's perfect for that role. That's exactly who you need for that role, because you need someone who's sort of gruff and to the point, but you can't go too far, because then you just have Mike, but you can't have a Saul. So you need someone who fills all these criteria for who that kind of person would be without repeating one of the character types we've already had on Breaking Bad. And so you but get also, Robert Forster.
And also beyond that, beyond like the character that he can play, the personality that he is and everything, the kind of roles that he's done and the personality, like he's not big, but he's great and he's the perfect presence. You know, Sarah and I, we love him from Jackie Brown, which of course we did a Tarantino cast on. Mm. He also did a little role as the detective in Mulholland Drive, which we did our first cast on.
And I just wrote an essay on. In fact, I wrote an essay on Mulholland Drive, but it was late because when I should have been finishing it off, I was watching an episode of Breaking Bad.
But also, and this is one that I don't think you know yet, but I talked about Medium Cool a couple of weeks back. That's Robert talking about how Slovis, like, I felt Slovis was influenced and kind of like Medium Cool was such a part of the show, like in Slovis's episodes in Confessions. Medium Cool, the main character in that, essentially, is Robert Forster. So that's another nice little tie there that I feel. He also played a baddie in the Delta Force, the Chuck Norris movie. But, you know, Robert for just perfect presence. And so, that's what we get in the cold open.
And Saul's then we find out that it's Saul's who's the one who's actually going. And this could be his final appearance.
Yeah.
Although, like, let's be frank, this is a functional cold open. This is one that's telling a story.
Yeah.
And it's kind of separate in the fact that it's all about Saul and about Walt. But don't tell story in your cold open. But then again, they had so much to get through, even though they now had 52 minutes, which worked.
Mm.
Really felt like it was good to have that extra time for this kind of long, trudging, pretty miserable episode. I think it needed more time.
Yeah, absolutely. So going from that cold open, we open on Marie and straight to the Nazis ransacking the Schrader home. And that was kind of a question that was quite obvious from Ozymandias, that Jesse was like, I've told you, it's just me, him, and his partner. I told you, like, just go and get it from his house. So, you know, that's pretty immediately going to be a point in this episode. So,
yeah.
At this point, I was also very excited because we talked about it during the Confessions cast, that I was talking about the potential of more footage from the confession being a possibility, and we do get it here, and I was really excited.
Yeah, and also I think that what was really interesting is the kind of taking away Marie as a character. Like, we kind of all thought, what's Marie going to do? And she didn't do anything.
Mm.
My girlfriend predicted, actually, that I asked her, so what do you think is going to happen this episode? And she goes, oh, I think Marie's going to move to the forefront this episode, which I kind of think was a reasonable prediction, but she's actually pushed back. And what I think this kind of effectively does is Marie's dead. She died along with Hank. As a character, she's just hollowed out. There's nothing left for her. She has been destroyed by Walt. The supporting cast was kind of played down quite a lot in this episode.
It's funny because, like,
kind of Schrader White focus for the first half. It's very much a Walt episode.
Yeah, after Ozymandias, like, you see Walt driving off into the distance, like, your main question. As I suppose the main question has kind of been throughout the whole show with peripheral kind of concerns. Like, your main concern really is Walt. And I was almost not expecting a bottle episode, but the sequence that we get with Walt, completely Walt-centric at the very end of the episode, is kind of what I was expecting from this episode.
Yeah.
So it is
well,
very
it's the
fitting.
Second half of the episode. It's not the very end.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, I suppose so, yeah.
But I thought that it would be Walt in New Hampshire, and they don't get
there
immediately.
Yeah, I was expecting that. Yeah, so, I mean, it was kind of interesting seeing it kind of go to the peripheral supporting characters for the beginning of it. But they're like single self-contained scenes apart from, say, Jesse and the Nazis. So with Skylar and Marie, you've got Marie in this first one. And then you've kind of got, I think Skylar's just with the lawyers. And it's all that really does is show you that Skylar's in the shit.
Yeah.
Kind of confirming what Saul and Walt kind of talk about in this. Well, I suppose, wait, we've got to get to Jesse in the dungeon.
Jesse in the dungeon, I mean, what's really interesting is he's kind of tearing out, you know, he's starting to, like, he's being really industrious. He's got the paperclip lock key, and he's kind of like the inner Heisenberg's coming out. All this time with Walt, he's kind of learned.
I was going to say MacGyver, but, you know.
Yeah, but that's what
Heisenberg
effectively is. He's kind of like a dark MacGyver when he's with Jesse. So it's like Jesse's learned from his time as sort of Walt's sidekick, and he feels like any problem that you get yourself into, there's always some kind of methodical way of getting yourself out. So it's interesting, even though that they're completely driven apart, their time together has imparted Jesse with the skills necessary to extract himself from the situation.
Yeah, I feel like in, like, you know, the one quote that's going to emerge from all of our podcasts on this is Walter White, the Dark MacGyver.
The Dark MacGyver. And two copies of Mr. Magorium's Wonder in Portland.
But also, so in this, when they're watching the confession, Todd is so pleased with himself.
I know. It's almost fucked. Like the mischievous, like, child is like, oh, come on, it's kind of cute. I know it's not good, but you love me, I'm Todd.
And then Jack picks up on his... what is it with Lydia?
I don't even want to talk about this. Crush, it's infatuation. So weird. Thing. It's like having a crush on your teacher.
It's so perverse. It's so perverse and just completely separate as well. It's like there's no contact of any kind there. It's very, very odd and unhealthy and just a bit fucked.
Yeah.
So yeah,
the whole thing's very strange. But also the whole idea of them watching the show, the confession and just laughing and belittling Jesse. It's taking you out of the comforts. You know, Alan Sepinwall posted this amazing review of the episode. And one of the things he kind of comments on is how we're sort of trapped in the reality of the show Coming Home to Roost. This isn't the kind of romantic honor amongst themes world that we sort of saw with Gus and the cousins. These are just really nasty, horrible people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of have all these big dramatic moments played out in front of you and just being treated with no sense of dignity and to have them essentially completely defiled by them. It's just really devastating,
yeah.
I think. And it's a really nice, if unpleasant, place to end the series. And I think a lot of people found this episode a bit dark and trudging, but I think it was perfect and exactly what we needed. I will say, though, that I think this first half kind of... it struggles to get there, but it's worth it. And then you get that great scene with Walt and Saul.
And you get a really nice transition from the vacuum. It's so much about kind of like... that kind of character that we've seen in Breaking Bad, like the small businessman who runs this really shady operation. Like, you've got the gun guy, the lot guy.
The venomous pest.
You know, but it's kind of this really nice shot.
And then you've got, mother of them all, Los Pueblos Hermanos.
Yeah, of course. So
A1 car wash.
Just Madrigal, generally. But you kind of see him in the vacuum... the vacuum repair store? And then the camera just drops down into the basement where you've got these two fugitive... well, one fugitive and one whatever fearful, the fuck fearful
Saul
guy.
Is. Although, yeah, well, Saul is also complete... like, he would... yeah, he yeah, would yeah. I just love that he points out you are on billboards. It's going to be hard to make you disappear. but... one of the things that is great about this scene is the way that it mirrors their conversation at the start of season 5, episode 1. You know, we're over. He says in the original, we're done. I say we're done. Mm. No, it's, you know, it isn't over until I... and it's just he's been torn apart by cancer. It's also...
You're also still seeing this, how he's still just blaming everyone but himself for this situation, and just anything going on is anybody's fault but his own.
So well, the thing is, he also just doesn't, he can't comprehend that it's over.
Mm.
Like, he's gone, he's disappeared. He can't comprehend what the mess he's left Skylar in. He thinks that one maneuver with the phone call at the end saved him and saved his family, and that's all there is. And he's got stuff to do, and he's got problems to solve, and he's got to go out and be Heisenberg. And Saul and the disappearer, Robert Forster, just say, no, you don't, that's it, this is the end.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And there's something else in Saul's presence that has just been so valuable the whole time. Like, and also just within the structure of TV, that stories kind of continue, where you've kind of got this situation where all this kind of crazy shit is happening. And often with, like, a lot of action films is you'll have all that, but you won't have any kind of concept of legal ramification or repercussion. And Saul is always the one who, like, after everything's in a neat little package, will go, bam, 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 Rico, whatever. Yeah. He'll just slam it all out.
He's just kind of like what they pitched in the writer's room. He's telling you the possible scenarios.
Yeah, he's just so on... I mean, he's on top of it in really weird kind of Saul-like ways. But the thing that I love so much about this scene is it is a full stop on Saul. And I love how exhausted he is.
I know.
But, and particularly in comparison to Walt, but the thing is their voices are exactly the same. As in the characters' voices that the writers have established so much, is that Saul is exhausted speaking the exact same way. Walt is trying to convince himself that he's not yet exhausted speaking exactly the same way. But the reality is that the situation has changed. Saul's the one accepting this, you know, but he is just that he is so far gone. He can still do the legal thing and he can still be the kind of counsel and say, you know, it's not just this kind of situation that happens and then virtue will out and it's all badass and that's the end of it. No, this is going to happen then. This is going to happen. With Saul, you have confirmation that shit is never over. But it's kind of funny that this is now kind of turned on its head and is the full stop.
Yeah, and also I like the fact that Walt's like, no, he's coming with me. We're going to sort this out together. Mm. It's like he's pitching this wacky buddy comedy where they go off together, plan their big comeback.
He's pitching a new plot, like a little subplot.
Yeah, it's almost like he's pitching a spin-off. But... But, you know, Saul just says, no, we don't, this isn't the next chapter in the wacky adventures of Walter White. And by comparison, a lot of the series feels like that, you know, it does feel so much more trite and kind of novel, I mean, compared to how bleak it's become.
Mm. And also, I'd just like to say, so yeah, just with all that, like, just, particularly just on this scene, like, and it's interesting that, you know, penultimate episode, we can kind of start to say this, is that kind of other characters that have fallen away so far, kind of maybe without, if they haven't died, like Hank's the one who we can, and Gomi are the ones who we can, you know, in concrete terms, say goodbye to. Saul is kind of the first one who we can say goodbye to, who is still alive.
Yeah.
So, you know, big pat on the back to Bob Odenkirk. Tremendous contribution to the show. See you
soon.
Do you think
we'll Better Call Saul will be him running a Cinnabon in Omaha?
But also, yeah, just on this point, like, you know, like the other, like he's the first one to kind of get a send off without dying. Huell is probably still sitting in that little motel room just with that. Because, you know...
Don't rule Huell out until the series is out. Maybe he will have a key role to play in the finale.
I really, really want him. I miss you, buddy.
Anyway, next act, we're with Skyler, and I just love... You know, one of the things that I think you kind of forget, you know, if you were to pick Skyler's key trait, she's one of the bluntest characters on the show. She really just tells it how it is. She's great at calling out Walt and kind of just, you know, I fucked Ted, you know, you're a drug dealer, etc. But when she's put in this position, she just lays it out on the table. I'm in a lot of trouble. You want my husband. I would give him to you. I can't. So it's very, you know, the way they do that scene, she's not listening, but she's not shut down. She's not catatonic. She just has no options left.
Mm.
And you think, well, that's our drop in with Skylar. We're just going to have a nice, pleasant scene of her smoking in her house.
Mm.
And she's going to go watch Holly. And it's an oh, fuck Nazis.
Yeah. It ain't season 2 or 1 anymore. No.
No one is safe. And it completely just destroys the illusion of safety you have in that house.
And the Nazis have penetrated every corner of the show.
Yes. The Nazis are just... Well, they're like this cancer unleashed by Walt. You know? But they are. I mean, they just are kind of... It's that classic sort of storytelling device of the what you unleash when you play with things that you just can't control. And the Nazis have just spiraled out of control. There's nothing aesthetically pleasing about them. There's nothing romantic about them. They're just horrific. And Walt is to blame for introducing them into everyone's lives.
Todd really is fucking insane.
Mm.
Todd is...
Well, the way he deals with Skylar in this scene is just so unnerving because he's so diplomatic. It's like, now we have a lot of respect for your husband and you've been talking to police and we know you got to do that. And then at the end, he touches her.
And that's the thing is that, like, because he is so threatening in his, just in the fact that he doesn't understand he is threatening. It's kind of like the, I'm sorry for your loss. Like, that came across to anybody as absolutely fucking terrifying. Just after Jack's killed Hank in Ozymandias. He's like, I'm sorry for your loss. It's the same here. He's like, oh, maybe I'll comfort. It's kind of like...
Yeah.
It's so, like...
Todd, usually Todd's sociopaths business.
Have some kind of idea of how they're manipulating or affecting people. Todd's kind of like this child, just like, oh, this is what you're supposed, you've seen people emote on TV. And he's like, oh, well, now you're sympathizing. You put the hand on the shoulder. Like, he's just fucking...
It's just like a total disconnect between Todd, the neo-Nazi mercenary, and Todd, the person. It's kind of like two people there. It's like he's a good cop, bad cop in one person.
But that's the thing, is that that's kind of what makes him
so unnerving.
So much of a crazy neo-Nazi is that just, yeah, that's another, you know, just part of his weaponry.
Yeah.
It's just fucking, and then insane.
He meets Lydia in the next scene. Oh, God,
and this is so weird.
I mean, this is great, though. I love... There's so, you got
Todd, who's useless and cold and insane, and Lydia, who's useless and cold and insane. And, you know, like, what does he say? Like, I think we really are good together. Like, yeah, you are.
Yeah. You work. But I think the thing about this, first of all, it has that great
Please
thing.
Go be perfect somewhere outside of a very large power structure.
Possibly in a box together. But the thing I love about this scene is when it starts out and Lydia's, you know, turn around. And it's just this incredibly awkward kind of, Todd's trying to come on to her while sitting behind her, and it looks so suspect.
Oh,
but
God.
All right, what's interesting about this scene, if you remember when we first met Lydia, there's that whole thing, do you have chamomile tea? No, we don't. Just water with lots of stevia. And then this scene, she finally gets the chamomile tea, and she finally, and you know, and I'm going to need more stevia. It's interesting that they focus on the tea here, and then they focused on it when she was with Todd in episode, I want to say...
I think 10? I think it was Rabbit Dog.
Rabbit Dog. I think it was Rabbit Dog.
Yeah.
No, wait. That Rabbit 12. Dog was 11. 12. 12. Yeah, 12. And I think that this could really hint towards, when we were talking about the rice in the last episode, this could be the explanation for, this could be foreshadowing.
Absolutely.
For the rice and...
Or just setting up that Lydia is fussy about her tea.
Mm.
I think the only thing that kind of, like, would mess with that is, like, can't immediately see a situation that would lead to Walt, like, supplying the stevia, just, like, swapping the packets and then coming up with, like some kind of really bad disguise, like in a waitress's uniform, just like, you're stevia, madam.
Yeah, I don't know how that plays out, but
yeah, but yeah, no,
the fact that they are emphasizing that definitely sets up alarms. It's like at the start of this season, the fact that Huel was doing more was a tip off to me that we were going to find out, and I was right, and I think this could be the same. But I'm not necessarily letting go to the possibility that Walt's poisoning himself. Also, what's just so freaky is the way that he uses the blue meth and having Jesse as a hostage as sort of a turn on. I've got blue meth, 92%. Come on, baby. And then at the very end, and cleverly they do it in a quite wide shot, you just get that little touch on the shoulder.
Oh, God, like picking a lint off her shoulder. Like they're primates just kind of picking stuff off each other. Oh, it's crazy. But also, just before that, there are two separate singles. And it's kind of, you know, it's really interesting. Like, normally just singles, like in a conversation, you've got one character looking right, another looking left, so you get some kind of sense of space. And if you jump across the line, then you get some kind of sense of disconnect and everything. And it's so interesting that this is kind of shot in that traditional way. But the reality is that that is the space they're in, that Todd is looking right and Lydia is looking right.
Yeah, it feels like a play really on a traditional bizarre.
Shot reverse shot, so it feels unnatural, but then you almost have to acclimatize yourself to the fact that it is. And as I think I mentioned on the Ozymandias thing, that this jumping the line has a subtle disconcerting effect. And then this, the whole thing is subtle and disconcerting.
Yeah.
So it just kind of fits completely. And you're just like, oh, God.
It's just also a massive piss take on the whole trope of the back-to-back rendezvous.
Yeah. The entire thing is like, Lydia, Christ's sake. Like, what are you doing? Like, yeah. I remember she tried to do that with Mike and he was just like, what the fuck?
She's so conspicuous in her inconspicuousness.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, so then we finally get to see Walt in New Hampshire, and part of me was like, finally!
A propane tank!
I've been waiting. Yeah, coming out of a propane tank. He's rolling around in a barrel. But he moves in barrels. He moves barrels. I was kind
you
of...
You just see him emerge from that into this, like, snow landscape from the vast dry expanses of Albuquerque.
Yeah, I mean, it's just visually the opposite, this snowy expanse.
It's so funny that that is almost his own personal version of hell, is like this snowy...
Well, it's not just hell, it's like purgatory. Yeah, it's just, you know, he's forced to do nothing. What's so brilliant about this whole thing, he can't get the money to anybody. Yeah. He can't really go out and spend it. He can pay the guy to get him stuff. At the end of the day, I think that it's just such a brilliant place that they've maneuvered it, the show into, where, all right, it would have been really great if, you know, Walt had, had lost all his money. It would have been great if he'd, you know, kept the money, but he'd lost his family. But what they've done is even more brilliant.
It's much better,
where
yeah.
they've kept the family, they've kept the money, but made it that the money has absolutely no value. They've managed to take a barrel full of money and just made it, completely worthless.
Yeah, it's so good. I love it.
It's just the perfect ironic end to, well, I mean, yeah. and know, also, penultimate and, moment for Walt.
And also just reflected in that, like with the continuation of this scene and this sequence, is that as the money becomes completely impotent in a way, so too does, he gets out the Heisenberg hat, puts that on, get Heisenberg and his theme tune, the typical slide the fingers along the front of the hat. He walks out the front to the gate and can't do it.
Yeah, he's just like, oh, maybe tomorrow. What,
you know, the and money, the money... That And the Heisenberg hat was so much a part of this kind of aggressive, destructive, powerful, controlling emperor figure. Yeah. And now he's this crazy old dude just locked up in his... It's not even a palace, it's a fucking log cabin in fucking New Hampshire. Like, it's brilliant. It's just all this stuff that used to have so much worth is just gone, and he's left with the fact that he's crumbling, decaying human. Yeah, exactly. But the thing is that it isn't just that he's lost everything. It's that he's got it, but what made it has completely changed.
Yeah, well, I mean, he has no identity, essentially. He doesn't have his family. He doesn't have Jesse. Oh, but what's also fascinating about this scene is he doesn't have a struggle. This is what I love about it. He says, what's keeping me from walking out this gate? He says, nothing.
Yeah.
You know, there's no obstacle for Walt now, because Walt feeds off, like, conflict and obstacles, but there is none of that now. He's completely trapped by himself now. Mm. And that's all, you know, that's such a powerful place for him to be in, because even when he has nothing, like he has had before, that struggle is what's kept him going. But he's got everything, and he's got nothing, and he can't do anything about it, and he's just stuck there with his barrel of money, his cancer, and two copies of Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium.
It really just, you know...
That was such a great touch. Why would they have two copies of Mr. Megorium?
What sequence of events seriously leads to that? It's like, two copies. Well, this guy's paying a good few $100,000 for this service. I guess I'd better get him the best.
Well, it just felt like... I feel like he probably has a few of these places, and he bought, like, multiple copies of Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium. He was meant to take, you
he's
know...
He's got, like, the packages for each house. That
yeah, one to
in,
each and house. And like, he screwed
so, like, somewhere someone's got, you know, just like, you've got Megorium's Wonder Emporium for your lightheartedness, and then you've just got, like, you got Salo and the other one. So someone's ended up with two Salos, and someone else has ended up with two Megorium's Wonder Emporium.
You know, I know which one is the actual torture. I think someone said that. He went, you know, well, I never thought I'd say this, but I think Walt got his just desserts. He had to watch Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium.
Twice.
And he would have watched it. He would have gotten so lonely and bored out in that cabin that, you know, he eventually caved and watched Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium.
That could have been the most heartbreaking moment.
The debasing cruelty of Vince
Gilligan. Oh my
god,
now that is an Easter egg I would love to see. Just watching Bryan Cranston play Walt watching Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium. No, but it'd be great if it just ended. And then he watches the credits roll and everything. He goes over to the DVD player, opens it, takes it out, goes and gets the other one, puts it in, and watches it again. So you've got this beautiful 3-hour long take, static long take Easter egg of Bryan Cranston sitting there weeping, watching Dustin Hoffman be a dickhead.
And of course, I just associate that with Bruno when he's got the remote stuck in his ass. I didn't mean to order Mr. Megorium's Wunderbar Emporium. Anyway.
We need to move on.
Anyway, back to Jesse and the Nazis.
Yeah, back to Jesse and the Nazis.
Todd.
More outrageous fun. Ben and Jerry's possibly the worst product placement ever.
Breaking Bad just has a thing about awful product placement. But yeah, I love the fact, you know, it would be kind of like, you can imagine the writing rooms. All right, so then, I know, he brings him ice cream. No, he brings him Ben and Jerry. No, wait. He doesn't. He brings him two flavors. and the flavors are peanut something and Americone, which is Stephen Colbert's, like, Ben and Jerry's flavor, which is just kind of...
It's genius. Yeah. I brought you Ben and Jerry's.
Americone dream. God, I don't know what that was. But
Christ almighty. That's awesome.
It's just surreal.
But yeah, and then Jesse has a really nice escape.
But the thing also, that must have been Aaron Paul doing that stunt where he jumps up. Because, I mean, I kind of thought, it's too close for this to be digital and it's sort of too fluid.
And it was a held take up until he kind of like stood up and everything and jumped up and reached it. So it was really impressive kind of.
Good on you, Aaron.
Good on you, buddy.
And then he escapes and you think, oh God.
Oh, Jesse's going to go on another adventure. Like, you know, it's like he's going to go out and he's going to buy a machine gun as well. So it's going to be Walt and Jesse from two sides just fucking gunning the Nazis down. But
the thing is also, you know, I thought, look, I know that he's probably going to get caught, but part of me thinks it's still possible, but no, they have to capture him, of course.
And then
he goes to Andrea, and Andrea and Brock, I mean, when Brock was slightly endangered, it was just kind of this sense of utter, a line being crossed, and then they just execute Andrea in the most routine, undramatic fashion after we had, you know, a whole season leading up to the death of Jane. Andrea is just dispatched of like that.
Andrea,
not Andrew. And yeah, it's just kind of, it's playing for keeps. And in his review, Seppenwall talks about essentially that, the show has kind of trapped us. The same way it's trapped Walt, it's trapped us, in that we kind of got suckered in by this really fun gangster narrative. And then when it comes to crunch time, it's like you unleash all these horrible people. You know, all these things that you think are sacred and safe are going to slip apart. It's just going to be horrific. Escape in Granite... I'll just quote him because it's really... Escape in Granite State is a fantasy. We discover that Walt's phone call at the end of Ozymandias wasn't a cure-all for Skylar's problem. So long as he stubbornly remains free, guarding money that it turns out will never make it to his family, Skylar will be a government target. You might think Breaking Bad wouldn't kill Andrea, that the show still, at this late date, has some boundaries it will not cross, but you would be wrong. The show we thought we were watching all along would not have done this. The show we were really watching all this time had to do this, no matter how hard it was for us and Jesse to witness. And Aaron Paul, I know you've been gunning for Dean Norris, but I want the Emmy now for Aaron again, just because... Ah! It's so just... brutal.
Christ almighty, what Jesse's just been... I know, I still want Dean Norris, you know, Aaron Paul's won it, and Dean Norris has been absolutely stellar.
I'm just disappointed, Jonathan Banks. Although, they were beaten by Bobby Cannavale, who gave an amazing performance in Boardwalk Empire. And if Boardwalk Empire deserved an Emmy, it was for that, and... Yeah, no, I was not too... But Jeff fucking Daniels!
Let's not get into it.
Jeff Daniels, that just ruined my day. Until I saw this.
I like Jeff Daniels, but not the newsroom.
He's not even better than John Hamm in that role.
Okay, so...
Anyway, I understand. We get the act break.
This is... Yeah, but just quickly, on Andrea's dispatching, which is what it is.
Yeah.
It's like, just in every sense of it, just from the Nazis, from a creative standpoint as well, it she's there and then she's gone. And it's almost like... You see Todd looking in the door, and the way that that is done as well, it's not like, for all you know, Brock could be right there. But the thing is, the way that it's shot is almost like the way Todd sees it, is that it doesn't matter if he is or isn't there in a way. It just, you know, it's just he's just looking in the door. Oh, why? Okay, sure. That's just the thing I'll do. Now I'll shoot her. Also, just so you know, this isn't personal. Like, what the fuck?
I know, and also the way they shoot it is clever, because you kind of think that he could be getting her out of the house to get Brock, and then he's going to kidnap them, it's going to be a whole thing, and it's just kind of, it's like, all right, they're raising the stakes for the finale by having, you know, Andrew and Brock, but no, she's just dead.
Playing for keeps, yep.
And then Brock is merely just a bargaining chip on the table.
Yep, and I hate fucking stakes. Stakes piss me off. Like, it's just like, just do it. Just
yeah.
Do something. I am with you. You don't have to pretend. You don't have to treat me like an idiot to get me interested. Like, I'm here and I'm sensitive to detail. But fucking hell. Like, it was almost like when it actually happened, it wasn't that I was in denial. Like, no, Andrea can't be dead. I was like, wait, what? She's, was that? That wasn't like a, oh shit.
Yeah, it was cruel.
Yeah.
Anyway, so...
So from this act break, I think it is important that we really distinguish that from here on in, this is almost the episode that we were... This is what we're expecting and really wanting. The other stuff was like in the same kind of old shit tradition that you get with Breaking Bad, but this is kind of Breaking Bad, like where it really...
Sad, slow Breaking Bad.
This is the drama Breaking Bad that really just does it better than most.
And am I correct? Well, beside the phone call, we don't actually leave Walt in this second half. Is that right? Or am I misremembering? I kind of stopped taking notes.
The point is that this sequence is very much a subjectively experienced one with Walt.
Yeah.
Is that we are in the space with him, and that's what it's all about. So, from the beginning of this ad break, you kind of got,
Well, the way they do it is really clever, because he comes, they shoot him behind the fence, and you see...
Out of focus, walking into focus.
Well, you see, he's covered with the hood, so you can't really quite work out, but it could still be, like, a week from where we left off. You know, he could still just have the goatee, but then you slowly realize he's got the beard, and then he goes into the house, and... he's got hair, and then he changes the glasses. And in a show that's all about transformation, you may think, oh, it's so weird not to end on Walt with the classic sort of Heisenberg appearance. But in a show that's all about transformation, I think it's really cool that they have one final metamorphosis to end things on.
Yeah, and also just on that as well, is that when the disappearer turns up, that shot on Walt walking into frame... And just, like, when he sees him and everything, he looks aged. He looks and feels and moves differently.
And I think,
like,
Cranston actually lost weight for this bit.
Yeah. Also, like, with the ring kind of falling off and everything else. When he just starts... I think it cuts to a wider one when he opens the gate and starts waving him through. When you watch him move, he looks like a 70-year-old in this sequence. Mm. And the way he waves him through, he looks like this old guy who hasn't seen anybody in a decade. He moves, he feels like a guy who's 70, who's withered, who's just decaying. And I mean, that's really where it's at right now. And that's why this sequence really just is so pregnant with just this kind of sense of just mortality, really, and just the decay of it. And I mean, it's so, I don't know, made such an impression on me. So, you know, when we kind of go in the log cabin, is this one note just incredibly diffused light through the windows once more, kind of gives that aura that we had in parts of Ozymandias in the house. But I think there's also a really nice detail, just quickly. He mentions that Skylar's taken her maiden name back, which is funny because
that was a bit strategically
just
weird.
So at the same time, she's like, oh, you know, she's shed your name. He's like, good, me too.
Yeah, but that's kind of bad because Lambert would, I don't know, but it's irrelevant really. But yeah, that whole sequence is so sad. And I kind of was sitting there watching and I was going, oh my God, in the end they did it. After all this going, after all me cursing his name, they've made me feel sorry for Walt again. He's got absolutely nothing. He is so desperate for attention, he will pay a man $10,000 to play cards with him
for an hour.
And
it just shows, yeah, where Walt's gotten to, just where he's just decayed.
It's such a hideous kind of end for him to meet. But also, I think that's, you know, the hitman, when he says, you know, you'll give them you'll give him my money when I die. And he says, would you believe me if I said I would? And of course he wouldn't. I mean, it's just too dangerous. He's a practical man. He's not being particularly cruel. He just can't do it. And the money can't go to them. And you think that's kind of just, that's something sacred in a narrative like this. When a dying man says, give my money to my family, you just say yes, like Jesse does in season 2 when he's, of course I'll take care of them. But no, that's not even on the table. Mm. He's got nothing. So we then see Walt falling asleep and his ring falls off. And it's this great... It's perfect because his kind of physical decay ties in with just...
The symbolism of like...
The
like
destruction the of the marriage. The structure, yeah.
Just like dissolving around.
Yeah, them, so they feed into each other.
Yeah, also just before you kind of jump too far beyond it, just the hour for $10,000 is such a... massive point, and it has echoes throughout the entire season. Series, you know, like calls to mind the reaction to when he gets the money from Tuco the first time post the fulminated Mercury explosion, and he has that moment in the car when you see him like display some kind of vitality for the first time after his cancer diagnosis. And then also maybe I mean, for me, because I still think it's in a way the most impressive moment of Breaking Bad for me, just purely on the sense that on second watch I realized that I'd forgotten it and it made a tremendous impact on me, was after he makes the deal with Gus from a year's employment and $12 or $15 million, I think it was, he just starts drifting onto the other side of the road like that as well. Just the way Walt has kind of reacted to and like related to money, and also Crawl Space where he just goes into this delirium, like after just the way it's all doing, just $10,000 for an hour at the end of that is just such a
he can spend his money on as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, that's such a beautiful kind of way of just kind of resolving one man's relationship with money, just like as kind of symbolic as the decay of his soul and the way that we've seen him just change.
So it's stripped down, seasons, and he just decides, well, I cannot rely on anyone. I've got, you know, I'm just dying here. I'm not kind of the original plan to escape so I can, you know, bide my time and come back. So I've just got to, you know, so from the $80 million, he gets down to $11 million. And then all he can send to his family is $100,000. It's not much, but it's what I need.
And it's so funny, just that, also just the very end of that scene, when they the disappearer starts dealing out the cards, he says, two cards, two kings. Or if to go along with the way I've kind of been looking at it the whole time, emperors, if you will. So, you know, in their own way, they're just these two emperors, like, despite the fact that their entire empires, in a way, are dissolved, like, they still have the remnants. They've got the, you know, the $10 million or whatever it is. But the reality is they're these two kings sitting in a log cabin in New Hampshire, completely isolated and alone, only spending time together because the terminal one, dejected, completely exiled from everyone he's ever loved or cared about, has offered 10 grand to the other.
Yeah.
You know, it's just such a beautiful little meditation on just the futility or just the ephemeral, corporeal nature of power, just like a human, that, you know, everyone's going to die. Doesn't matter how much fucking money you have.
It's beautiful. And then he, you know, he tries to give that money to Junior. Mm. And you think this is kind of the possible motivation or there's something, but no, this can't be. He can never, that ship has sailed. He will never explain himself to Junior. He will never be able to make them understand. You know, the first thing we see him do is really say, just understand, Skylar and Junior, that I did this for you. That's the first thing he does in the series. I mean, in terms of what we see.
It's the thing that he does for the rest of the series in his mind. That is always his first
rationale. And he can't. He loses that fight. And that, in theory, destroys him because he thinks that's all I had, because he thinks in his mind everything he's ever done is for his family, and when it becomes clear that he's lost this, he decides to turn himself in. But that's not what it is. We know that there is Heisenberg Wald is motivated by an incredible sense of arrogance and ego and a sense of pride. The reason that we kind of understand that the real reason he's doing this is because he feels like he was cheated out of his birthright. You know, he was a man who should have been destined for great things and instead became a nobody. And so you kind of think of all this. And we've been talking about how much we wanted to see Grey Matter kind of come back.
Mm.
And then... the time so many elements have been introduced in with, you know, they've tied off so many loose ends and the Nazis and all these plot threads. And I kind of just accepted the fact that they weren't coming back. And then he flicks on the channel and there they are.
But yeah, the thing with this is that, you know, there are so many kind of... The reality of having such a complex character is that there are a lot of wells you can go to kind of like elicit a response. And that's the thing with a lot of kind of three-act structures or shorter form stories is that you can kind of limit the range of a character's flaws or the ways in which they manifest themselves, both in themselves dealing with themselves or other people, or like beyond that, certain character dynamics bring out certain kinds of flaws. The reality is that his entire relationship with Walter Jr., he's never had to be honest. Like, going to Walter Jr. was always like an unlimited source of sympathy. Like, whatever it was, he wouldn't have to justify almost any... Just hero worship from Walt Jr. was all he ever had.
Yeah.
Now, he just had that completely destroyed, didn't know how he was going to respond. And the thing that's so... You know, I mean, you did have a slight callback to just about one of the only moments where Walt Jr. kind of views him as this... Not even that, but when he says, just fucking die, it was a callback to season 1, episode 4, Cancer.
Yeah. Man.
So, you know, but
that... He actually wants him to die this time.
Exactly. So that is the, you know, it's such an important moment to kind of bookend their relationship in a way.
Yeah.
And again, the cyclical nature of everything. And also, and this is like, might sound like just a shout out or anything, but we haven't seen Carmen since season 3, episode 4. And she comes back into this to lead him into the office. And that would have been like a really nice thing on set. Like
yeah, that they go back to the high school right at the end.
Yeah, and you've got this actor who we haven't seen for 2 seasons, but she is there and...
Right before the Schwartzes come back.
And it takes you back into that entire stage before anything was known. Really situates you in a space, particularly for the school with, I suppose, the key characters ever in that space were Walt, Carmen and Walt Jr. in a time when Walt Jr. was completely trusting of everything his father put in front of him, or rather didn't, and just trusted what he did.
And also also just the space that we associated with Walt at his most kind of you know, as Mr. Chips, as the teacher,
exactly, like man. It's really taking it back to this space, which you know, and again, we've kind of talked about space on either side of a phone call, this one particularly, because the space of the school and everything that kind of goes along with that is so much the opposite of this
dingy bar
in New Hampshire, where he's gotten the, gotten some cocktail waitress or somebody to do Saul's, secretary did.
He loves impersonating Marie.
Yeah. He just, or rather like, you know, so just that whole thing is just so, I don't know, just preserving either side of that space-time thing was just so important for just that character snap, and also making us feel it as well, and I just felt it really hard. So then you go straight from that into, I'd like to talk to the leader of the Walter White investigation, who may I say is calling Walter White, drops the phone,
he's decided, and he's gone, all right, that's it. He's called the police on himself, he's ordered a Wimple Pig, Vince Gilligan's favorite,
a dimple pinch, Wimple Pig, nice,
a dimple pinch.
But it was a really interesting moment, like there again, seeing his. I was like, talk to somebody in charge of the Walter White investigation. Pause, Walt. Like, who am I to say is calling? Pause, Walter White. Like, he could have. Again, hanging on what he was going to say there, and you know, we've had so much kind of talk about the Walter White, Heisenberg, and just like all these kind of different aspects of one man. And then he goes to the bar and gets the dimple pinch. And not only that, but he gets it neat.
Neat, yeah.
Which is a massive... And I mean, I feel like this is obvious. I picked up on it immediately. But why? What do you... So yeah, you know, because we've kind of like seen in past how Walt adopts the behavior of the people that he, kills, and one of those was after he killed Mike, he had his dimple, or just his whiskey or rum or whatever it was,
on the rocks, and now it's
as neat
Mike
again. Did, and now it's neat again. It's coming back to some kind of last. Again, we have so many last vestiges of Walt. It's kind of silly to kind of count.
Anyway, let's talk about Grey Matter, because you know he comes back and he's got nothing. He hasn't got the money. He hasn't got the family. So he kind of assumes, because Walt isn't always the most perceptive person, he assumes, I've got nothing to live for. I've got nothing to defend. I've got nothing I can defend. I've got nothing I can fight for. I'm going to turn myself in. And then it all clicks for him. And remember, and this is the thing, I kind of, as I was watching it, I was going, oh my God, it all makes sense. The tagline for this season, and not just the tagline, fucking plastered over his face is remember my name. And you kind of think, all right, yeah, that makes sense. That's kind of just a nice hubristic statement, but that makes sense. In the end, that's all he has left to defend. So he's not going to be left as kind of, you know, Walter White is nothing, who has no, he's gone, who had nothing to do with Grey Matter. He's not going to disappear in this cabin, because that's what would happen. He would just fade away in this cabin. No, he has to go out. He has to defend his legacy and make a splash for better or for worse, because he's caught. His family hate him. He cannot do anything with his money. The last thing he can
do is define his name,
both as Walter White, reclaim his identity as Walter White, the brilliant scientist, and reclaim his name as Heisenberg, the man to be feared.
The Emperor.
So I think that's such a brilliant thing to give him the final motivation to go back.
Absolutely, his name.
And because we kind of had all these pragmatic reasons why he might go back, and in the end of the day, it's not really that. I mean, he's going back for the Nazis, you assume. But it's not that. It's just, it's one of the core character components that we haven't quite explored this season. Because this season has actually really been him in a very kind of practical, functional level. You know, it hasn't been about his ego and his hubris in the same way it was last season, where he was doing everything for the sake of doing it. This season, we haven't had that. So we've stripped Walt of everything piece by piece until he's left with nothing. Now he has his name. That's what he goes to defend. And as we get this realization about who he is, what he has left, whether for better or worse, that's all he has. The Breaking Bad theme finally comes in, the first time it's used in the show itself.
All
that's left is a glass. He's returning to Albuquerque. We're set up for what we've seen back, you know, that something that's been playing in our minds for over a year now.
And just ultimately the nature of the circumstances that would lead to his return.
Yeah, it's
and
perfect.
It is so much a part of that elusive kind of both the nature of the Heisenberg Walt character, but also the way that this story has been told.
But it's a combination of the two. I feel like Adam Lambert, right?
I think so.
Yeah, it represents the breakdown between the distinction of Walt and Heisenberg, because there's no need for that distinction anymore. Everyone sees him as the same person. Mm. And this final moment is he's reclaiming his name as Walter and as Heisenberg, because the Schwartzes are denying him his importance in... the Schwartzes and the Nazis for him are sort of like mirrors. They denied him the role of scientific genius in his eyes. And the Nazis denied him his role as kingpin. They took his money. So he's kind of conflated them as one, and he's going back just to reclaim that position as top dog so people will remember his name.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think there's so much to be said as well for there's like the kind of broader things, but again, with a show so complex and everything, the way that different character dynamics draw out different particular flaws of different intensities and different kind of permutations, and the Gretchen and Elliot flaw that draws out of him is kind of unlike anything else, and it makes so much sense that is what riles him up
at the
so
very
much
last moment.
from what is about to be his eternal slumber, essentially, is that this, I mean, the line on the TV that they say that catches his attention is, for us, it's always been science first.
Yeah.
And you know, that's so much like, he's like, he
Which
believed,
is essentially what he's pitched to Jesse he is believes, at the very start. It's all about the science.
Yeah, he believes himself to be, like, in comparison to that, like, what, it's not for me? Like, I'm every bit the scientist that either of you ever were, you ever could be. Like, to him, like, he really is, you know, just has so much and is so much, and that people really need to appreciate that and not take a, you know, take even a slightly askance view of him. Like, he has to be in control of the way people see him. And even if it means them seeing him to be this evil, decrepit, disgusting, destroyed man, at least it's better than, you know, is Walter White still out there? No.
Yeah,
like, you
exactly.
Know, and you're just like this complete denial of his existence, you know. And they almost like it, the way they kind of talk about it. And this is another aspect. I mean, we've kind of talked about it, like the kind of the domestic, then the mythic, and then kind of waiting for the national news story that Jane hints at, like very early on, like in season two. That is such a massive part of it in the 24-hour news cycle, is that the ramifications of this are so massive. And that when it's finally realized, all you see is a couple of newspaper clippings on his wall and Gretchen and Elliot
Schwartz.
Well,
this is what I was talking about in the Ozymandias.
In an interview with Charlie Rose. Like, that is... And even then, like, you can tell that interview, that was like even in the scale of it, that's a 3-minute segment of what was probably like a 20-minute, half an hour interview.
You see, I was talking about this in the Ozymandias discussion. Podcast, whatever we call these things, how we never saw Marie being told about Walt, and we never saw Walt being told, and we never saw the public at large being told. We were denied all those moments, and we just saw the aftermath of them.
You see
the
fallout.
Yeah, you see the fallout of it, and you see the clippings, and you see the thing, but they never had that moment. So it's interesting how they've kind of kept that consistent, and it works because they've kept it consistent.
Mm. And that's the thing, like, you almost get, like, the remnants of an echo, and you can tell exactly where
it came
from. Yeah,
you don't need it. And you kind of knew that with the whole High Carol flash forward.
Yeah.
Like, which we're going to see. It'd be interesting to see.
It's so brilliantly executed. You only need a couple of tiny little reverberations to kind of understand the entire cultural sphere in which this is all taking place.
I'd be interested to see how they work in those flash forwards next episode. Anyway, we really should wrap this up.
I went
episode.
Back and watched them as well, and I'm just like, I'm not even excited about next week. I'm just like, this is going to happen, and it's going to be exactly what it should be.
Yeah.
You know?
That's what I thought about this episode. It didn't have the same, oh my God, quality as Ozymandias.
And I don't think that's a bad thing.
No, I loved it. I just thought it was perfectly what we needed from the penultimate Breaking Bad. It was so satisfying on so many levels, so profoundly sad. And kind of such a fitting sort of almost final statement on who Walter is and what he values. So, favorite moment?
Just quickly. It's kind of, I know what you mean. Just like, and it's such a unique experience. Like, I can't speak to other TV shows because I haven't seen any in the way that I have Breaking Bad. Well, I mean, I've kind of finished them, but I haven't like dedicated as much time and attention and love to a show like one like this. And to kind of go out every week on executive producer Vince Gilligan, there has been such a panoply of emotions attached to that title card. And now to kind of have one where before it even comes up, you know it's coming, you've just rested on a dimple pinch, neat, with police swarming everywhere, you've kind of got this suggestion of so much, but you know that it's not like this vast world, like, oh shit, so many things could happen. Like, you just say, this is, you feel the conviction so much. And I just raised my arms in the air. I was just like, yes, this is where, it's, there's a conviction.
This is where it needs to
there's
be.
A conviction that I feel here that is just so brilliant. I'm just like,
All right. So have you got any rough predictions for the finale before we do that? I mean, I kind of have vague ones. Like, I do think, you know, some people still think he's going to shoot up Grey Matter. Like, no, sorry.
I reckon Jesse and Brock will walk off into the sunset with David Cassidy playing.
I think the most likely at this stage is he's got to take out Jack and the Nazis. And Jesse was involved. And I think Walt will aid Jesse without Jesse aiding Walt.
I don't think there's any way.
I think Jesse's got to take down Todd, well, I don't know.
Tell you what I'd really like to see.
Well, we know there's a big-ass machine gun, and we know that he's gonna go back to the Nazis. I think that's all we can say for sure. How it plays out within them, who the Ryerson's for, all that kind of stuff, is anyone's guess. We only have a week to wait. Why waste time speculating?
What I'd love to see is that, because we've seen so much about how Jesse really is kind of the one at the one at the center of all this, with a conscience and with some kind of sense of humanity still in him. I'd really love to see him with the opportunity to kill Walt and not.
Yeah. I think that could work. Could he do it? I don't know. Anyway, we'll see. So, favourite moment?
You first.
I think I generally go... I mean, it's a toss-up between the scene when we come back and Walt's getting the treatment and he's kind of, you know, realises that the money won't go anywhere and he has to pay him the $10,000. I thought that was really moving.
Mm.
But... also, I have to give props to the whole Gretchen Elliot TV interview moving into the theme playing. I thought that was so perfect. And it was just, it was weirdly, it wasn't like a fuck yeah Heisenberg moment, because it wasn't that. It was just kind of like, yes, good, good. This is, it's all.
This is really slotting into place.
This is all coming into place.
This is hitting every spot.
Yeah, so what about you?
Absolutely. Gretchen and Elliot. I mean, one, because I've wanted to see them integrated back in for so long, because it is such a massive part of the Walt Heisenberg, Adam Lambert hubris that we've kind of seen for so long, that I just felt like it was a well that couldn't not be
returned
to. But also just in the sense that I have kind of again been considering how this affects the broader kind of culture of, I suppose, America and the world, and that we see that only in an interview on Charlie Rose, and it's so brilliant because they didn't overdo the ABQ situation, the 737 down over ABQ. It was very much contained, but you had a suggestion of how big grand and massive it was. And it's although you did have
that whole montage with the media. Yeah. I was wondering if they were going to do that again with Walt. And it could have worked. And maybe they still will.
That we've got it now with Gretchen and Elliot is just so, so small, but so massive.
What's also great is, they have an impact on the plot without, unrealistically getting involved in the plot. Anyway, and also the funniest moment is Mr. McGorham's Wondering Emporium, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, right.
We did giggle about it for a good few minutes.
Yes. Then, anyway, we got to go. Thanks so much for listening. We've got one more main episode left for Felina. The final episode, God knows how long that's going to be. Thanks so much for listening. Sorry about the technical difficulties. We will get the finale up if we have to, murder someone with a working studio. Email us at cavaliersdocinema@gmail.com. Visit our blog, cavaliersdotelevision.blogspot.com. Get your emails in, because this is your last chance to have sort of input on the discussion live. We'll be back after the finale to have like a massive top episodes, favorite directors, ranking the season.
We're going to do our season 4 retrospective. We're going to do 5A, maybe 5B again, with the benefit of hindsight. We're not done with.
We got to do the big retrospective.
Yeah.
And we're
going to do a massive Breaking Bad. Massive Breaking Bad.
I think we might do it is get those season 4, 5 ones out, so it times with the complete series being released on DVD. That's a big release, so that kind of capitalizes on it. That sounded gross. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week for the end. Have a good one.